Good morning, brothers and sisters, friends. Several weeks ago, we looked at the subject of suffering and pain, and this is a continuation of that. We call it Suffering and the Purpose of God, Part 2. We ended with a verse that I would like to begin with today in John 16, verse 33. Where Jesus said, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." And we can just recap a little bit of what we talked about before, for those of you that missed it. But I reminded us of how we love the promises of God, and we quote the promises of God, and we sing the promises of God, and we encourage each other with the promises of God, but this is one promise that sometimes we don't like as much and maybe don't take note of as much as some of the others that are a little more positive. But Jesus promised this, and just as sure as this promise is true, or just as sure as the other promises are true, this one is also a reality. But Jesus told us that in the world you will have tribulation. And he encouraged us in this same promise of reality, of the reality of pain and suffering and tribulation. He encouraged us that in him we can have peace because he's overcome the world. And we talked a little bit about how God is present in suffering. God loves me. He's not against me. He's not out to destroy me or hurt me. He is not distant or separated when I'm going through suffering, but he's very present in the midst of my suffering and my trouble. Also, that God is not the author of evil. Sin and evil are the result of man's choice to eat of the tree. All sin and suffering has been the outworking of sin in the garden. Suffering should be expected for a Christian. And we looked at some of those scriptures, but as we go through the Bible and we see all those promises and all those scriptures that just assume that a Christian is going to have a life of suffering. And we looked at the past and how Christians in the past have viewed suffering and just accepted and embraced that as a part of following Christ. All who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. And Peter talked about not thinking it strange when we're beset by those fiery trials. And so you have different aspects of suffering. You have persecution and opposition to the faith. And then you also have just the trials of life. You know, Christians are subjected to many of the same sicknesses and diseases as the rest of the world. And we demonstrate to the world the grace of God as we go through those times of suffering. So Jesus said, I have spoken to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. There's another area of suffering that we didn't touch on so much, and Hebrews 12 talks about that. In Hebrews 12, verse 3, he says, "For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your own souls." So we should consider Jesus when we're going through these sufferings and difficult times. We should consider Jesus who went before us as an example to us of a man of suffering. In fact, the Bible calls him a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. So he reminds us of Jesus, and then he tells us we haven't resisted yet to bloodshed. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons, "My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges," uses a strong word, "every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father, spirits, and live? They indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, But he, for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. And so, God, this is not so much punishment from God, although some might tend to look at it that way, but I think of it rather as simply training. God is using the disciplines of life to train us in righteousness. And when we embrace that, when we submit to that, it brings forth the peaceable fruits of righteousness to those who are trained by it. If I warn you not to run blindfolded, and you disregard my warning, and you run and you hit this wall, it's not like I'm angry at you. It's not like I'm punishing you, because the pain is not a result of my anger towards you or punishment towards you. The pain is simply a consequence of your choice. And sometimes with God's discipline, that's what we are experiencing, is God just allows us, in order to train us, because he loves us, because we're his son, he allows us to suffer from our own stupidity and wrong choices. And we, if we have an ear for God and a humble heart, are willing to learn from that and not just keep repeating those same mistakes. So that's an aspect of suffering that, in a sense, we bring on ourselves by our own choices. It's simply the consequences of bad choices. And God loves us enough to not always shield and protect us from that, because he wants us to learn from those things. And he even allows us to learn in the hard way at times. So we want to continue to look at the purpose of God in suffering. And I thought about the story of Joseph, a story that most of us are very familiar with. Joseph is this young boy. He's a favorite of his father. He's probably a secure young man. You know, he's really got everything. He's got his father's love and attention. He's probably a very secure child, and growing up in a home with a lot of siblings, a big family, and somehow he always kind of gets on the wrong side of his brothers. And maybe there's a little bit of ignorance in Joseph's life about how to communicate in a little more, in a nicer way, or in a way that's better received. But I think for the most part, we would say Joseph was an innocent victim of circumstances. And God was working in Joseph. God was preparing Joseph for the future. God was giving him dreams. He was sharing these dreams with his brothers. And it caused jealousy. Once again, no fault of Joseph's, but he became a victim of his brother's jealousy. And he probably experienced rejection from his brothers very early in life. Even though he had a wonderful father that loved him and doted on him, and yet there was probably, from his broader family, there was probably a lot of rejection. And so Joseph experienced the bitterness of rejection at a very young age, and I don't doubt that it affected him, as it does all of us. And He was continuing to relate to them as his father wanted. He took some bread to them, or whatever it was, some food, and found that his brothers had conspired against him, threw him in this deep pit, and then sold him into slavery. They wanted to kill him. And if you don't think that was traumatic, I mean, just imagine going through that. Having your own flesh and blood turn against you and want to kill you, want to destroy you, and want you out of their life. And so they sold him into slavery, and here's this young boy, this young man, snatched out of the security of his home in a very vulnerable place with strangers, slave traders, and sold into a strange, foreign, godless nation, country. And there Joseph was, and I think really all he had was faith in God. I think somehow through all of those difficult things, Joseph maintains his own integrity and his own heart and faith and confidence in God as a great example to all of us. But here he is, and living before God in a very honorable way. And Potiphar's wife wants him, and he's, by God's grace, he's strong, he resists her advances, And through that, she becomes angry with him and falsely accuses him. So first of all, rejection, and then false accusations. I mean, talk about injustice to a high level for a young man. I mean, that would put any one of us to an extreme test to be able to go through those things and not become very bitter and disillusioned against God. I mean, God, why? What have I done? Do you think those questions went through Joseph's mind as a young man? I'm sure they must have. He was real. I mean, he was like you and I. He was flesh and blood. He was not some supernatural man above temptations and struggle. So I'm sure Joseph must have wrestled with those things. Joseph must have wrestled with questions about why. Why are you allowing this, God? What have I done wrong? Maybe he at times felt like God was against him and angry with him and punishing him for something. I don't know. But those are the temptations in times like that, to feel that way. Because everything about my life is not just. I don't deserve this. I didn't do anything to deserve this. And here you have Joseph cast into prison and forgotten. And you know, we read the story and we know the beginning to the end and we're there. And it would be easy for us to come along and just encourage Joseph. Joseph, there's a bigger picture here. There's a whole nation that you're going to save. God is going to do amazing things through this trial. Hang in there, Joseph. It would have been wouldn't it have been a wonderful thing if we could have come alongside Joseph in that prison and encouraged him in that way? But see, Joseph didn't know this. For all he knew, he was going to rot in prison. He was never going to see the light of day again. So he went through this, not understanding or seeing the big picture. And that is where it becomes difficult. When we see the big picture, hey, we can go through just about anything because we see light at the end of the tunnel. We know this is not going to be forever. We know that we're going to come out victorious at the end and God is going to do great things. It's another thing when God is silent. See, God was not explaining this to Joseph as he went through it. God was silent. And I'm not saying God wasn't there to comfort him and to strengthen him, but I don't think God was just laying out the whole plan to Joseph as he went through it. And so Joseph endured, Joseph persevered, and at the end in Genesis 45, when his brothers come to him and this whole thing starts to unravel, and they came to him in Genesis 45, verse 4, and Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near me." So they came near. Then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life." And so you see, Joseph is beginning to see the bigger picture. He's beginning to see that this was not all in vain. This was not all senseless and useless. God had a purpose through all of these things. God had an eternal purpose through all of these things. And God is actually not going to waste all this pain and all these years, but God is going to use them for a greater purpose. And I think that encouraged Joseph. I think Joseph was encouraged at the end that as he began to see what God was doing in this big, bigger picture of his life and the life of those around him. In fact, later on when Joseph's father died, his brothers were still afraid that Joseph is going to now come after them and kill them. He would have had a power to do that as his position in Egypt. And so they were fearful of that, and they came and they essentially begged him, you know, to spare their life. And if Joseph would have been a bitter man, if Joseph would have been eaten up with bitterness and resentment, I think he probably would have taken that opportunity at that time to bring some justice, to bring the scales a little bit even here. But I think Joseph demonstrated that somehow, through this whole process, he was able to commit his life to God in such a way that he was not eaten up with bitterness and resentment and anger. And here he was, and he came to his brothers, and he said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" So Joseph understood that it is in God's place to even the scale. It is in God's place to right the wrongs. It is in God's place and in God's time to do that. And he said something that I think rings down through the centuries to our time and our age, and I think can be a source of encouragement to us today. But he said this, he said, "You meant it evil against me." So he wasn't excusing what they did. He wasn't watering down the sin. He wasn't lessening it. He wasn't just ignoring it or brushing under the carpet. He said, "Yes, you meant it for evil. You had evil intent in what you did. But God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now, suffering often involves pain. As much as it may feel like it at the time, pain is not a curse. Did Joseph feel pain? I'm sure he did. I'm sure he felt tremendous pain. I'm sure he felt pain maybe even when he shared this expression of forgiveness to his brothers. Maybe he still felt some pain. The years that were lost. I mean, they were still lost. The reality is he never got those years back. He never experienced all that he could have experienced as a young boy growing up in his father's home. They were lost forever. And believe me, I don't doubt that Joseph was aware of that. Maybe sometimes painfully aware of that. These are the years that I could have spent growing up with my dad. He could have taught me these things. He could have been there when I went, had this birthday. And I mean, I don't doubt that those were very real to Joseph, even as he expressed forgiveness. And as he acknowledged the sovereign hand of God over those things. Suffering often involves pain. Pain is not a bad thing. God has purpose in our pain. Often God is able to get our attention in pain. Pain can have a purifying and maturing effect on us. Pain can enable us to feel for others as nothing else can. Pain is often simply an indication of something else. A person with leprosy-related nerve damage, I understand, does not feel pain. It kills the nerves that would indicate pain. And so a person with leprosy can actually lose fingers and toes and not feel that. And so especially now, in modern times where leprosy is treatable, we would say that it would be a blessing for a leper to be able to feel it coming on and know, hey, there's something wrong. And not just go about his life unaware that there's a problem and then start losing fingers and toes when it's too late. But we would say in this case, pain would be a blessing that would give him an indication, hey, there's something going on. I need some treatment. I need some help. Last week, I went through a bit of an episode with my chest and my shoulder. I guess I'd been, as I thought about it, I believe it all kind of points back to, I've been doing some more biking at an evening after work. I'll bike around the block trying to get some more exercise, and I'm thinking with all the pressure on my shoulder and neck, some damage started, and it crept on me slowly. I noticed a few times I wake up at 3 in the morning with a backache, and I thought it was my pillow. I tried getting a couple different pillows, nothing seemed to help, and it kept getting worse. And last week, one morning at 3 o'clock, I woke up, and I knew I was in trouble. I couldn't move. And so I need to go to the bathroom. So I work my way out of bed, and as I'm heading to the bathroom, everything locks up, and I go into a cold sweat, and my head starts to spin. And I don't think I woke my wife up that night. I managed to get back into bed, and got through the rest of the night somehow. Got up the next morning, and went to work, and as I went through the day, it started loosening up a bit, but it was a pain in my chest and shoulder. And I crossed my mind a few times that maybe it's heart-related, but I didn't worry about it too much. Kept getting better, and that evening I thought, you know, maybe a few days here and I'll be good. Well, that night, or 3 o'clock the next morning, or 2 o'clock, whatever it was, I woke up and I knew I should have done something. It was bad. I mean, I knew I needed to sleep on my back, and when I sleep on my back, I snore really bad. And my wife didn't want to poke me like she usually does, because she wanted me to get some rest, so she had actually gone out on the couch. I was sleeping out there. And I knew I'm in trouble. I could not move. And when I moved the wrong way, it would just, my muscles would go into a spasm and lock up. And anyways, I managed to slide over to get my feet off the side. I dropped down on my knees. I managed to get up, but then I was locked into place. And so I was out here, and I went into the kitchen, and I sat down in a chair, and I'm sitting there at 3 in the morning. I'm trying to figure out, what do I do? Well, my wife woke up right about then, and she discovered I'm not in bed, so she goes charging through the house looking for me and finds me in the kitchen, and she took one look at me and she said, I'm going to take you to the doctor. So me protesting all the way, we headed out to the van, and then I had a problem. I couldn't get into the van because I couldn't move my neck. So that was probably my worst moment. I realized, you know, I'm here, I'm locked up, it's just crazy. We managed to get me in the back seat. We got into the Emerge. The doctors, they did all the heart testing and everything and basically confirmed what I knew already, that I wasn't having a heart attack. It was all muscular related. So they stuck a needle in my arm to loosen the muscles up, gave me some nasty pills and sent me home. And I've been on the mend ever since. My point in saying this is that even though the pain was excruciating, I don't think I've ever experienced back pain quite like that. But if I wouldn't have had any pain, I would have just kept on biking and using my shoulders, and I would have probably done irreparable damage. And so pain was simply a wake-up call to me that there's something wrong. There's something that needs to be taken care of. And I think it's that way emotionally and spiritually as well. Pain is not our enemy. And there's times where we look at pain as the enemy, and we avoid pain. We avoid painful situations. If we get into something that reminds us of something in the past and we have this huge reaction, we just get away from that. And there's people that will move all over the globe to get away from pain. There's people that will leave churches. There's people that will leave relationships. And they will constantly be on the lookout for pain. Anything that reminds them or stirs that up, they'll run away from it. And that's unfortunate, because God invites us to embrace that pain with Him and find healing. I think that's God's solution. Not to run from it, not to hide from it, not to quit relationships, not to run away from churches, but just to acknowledge it. Maybe it's nothing bad I did. It's nothing to be guilty about. It's nothing to be ashamed about. It's nothing to run from. It's simply that God is saying, I'm just trying to get your attention. I want to do something in you. I want to do something wonderful in you. I want to heal you. I want to restore you. Don't keep running from it. But just stop and open your heart to me and allow me in there to do a work of grace and a work of healing and restoration. He is the balm of Gilead. He is the healer. He is the restorer. He invites us to give our pain to Him in exchange for His healing. Now, it's one thing to suffer as a Christian. You know, 1 Peter 4 tells us, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial. And we understand that, and we see that the bigger picture in our trial, in our tribulation, and we find encouragement in the scripture. We rejoice to the extent that we are partaking in Christ's suffering, so that when His glory is revealed, we may be also glad with exceeding joy. When we're reproached for the name of Christ, we remember that Jesus said, blessed are you, because you are reproached for the name of Christ. If anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this manner. So that's one thing, to suffer as a Christian. It's one thing to suffer from our own stupidity and our own wrong choices. I mean, we can understand that, right? It's easier to accept that. It's easier to embrace that. Yes, I made a foolish choice. I'm suffering from that. I can find God's grace in this, and we can wrap our mind around that. We can go to Hebrews 12 and we can say that it's actually because I'm a son that God is chastening me. And we can see God's purpose, as Joseph said, that you meant it against me for evil, but God meant it for good. And now we're beginning, this whole mystery is beginning to unravel, and we're seeing God's purpose through it. And we're looking back to when we were 12 and what we went through, and now we're 48, and we're saying, even though that was very painful and very difficult, I can see how God has brought me through, and God has brought healing and purpose, and I can even see some ways that God is using that, and that's all wonderful. But I tell you, this whole thing goes to another level when we do not see any purpose in it. And I think about Job. And once again, as with the story of Joseph, so it was with Job. Job did not get any explanation from God. I mean, it was even different than Joseph. Joseph understood some things in the end that I think he found comfort in. Job did not. Job never had any answer to his questions. God never answered Job on any of the painful questions that he had. Job desperately wanted an explanation from God. Job desperately wanted a reason. He wanted to understand the why. He wanted to understand why God allowed this. He wanted to understand what he was even willing to say. God, if I've done anything wrong, I'll own up to it. I'll take responsibility for it. He was there and he was saying, God, just show me what I've done wrong and I'm willing to die for it. He desperately wanted to hear from God. And why not? I mean, look at what he went through. Look at what he endured. Hey, David, it's good to see you. Welcome. Haven't seen you for a while. But he desperately wanted to understand what God was doing, and he wanted to have an explanation, and I think that's only natural. I think that's very understandable. I mean, you lose your whole family in a very drastic way. And you suffer incredibly in your own life. You lose your friends. You have your own wife turning against you. And so just about everything that could go wrong went wrong, and then some more. But in that whole story, as you go all the way through, and you realize at the end that Job never had an explanation. And it's easier for us because we see the behind the scenes. We saw the scenario with Satan and what was happening, and we were like, yes, Job, hang in there. There's some spiritual warfare going on. There's something happening in the heavens that you cannot see. And we would have been great encouragers for Job. But God did not allow that. God did not allow his friends to see what was going on. So essentially, God was silent. Through the whole thing, God remained silent. And those are the most difficult times. When God is there to comfort us and encourage us, that's one thing. When God is silent, that is very difficult. And it is in those times that we are the most vulnerable to becoming offended with God, with ourselves, and with life, and becoming disillusioned. And unfortunately, it's in those times where people walk away from God. Well, Job, even though he never had answers, he did get to this place. He said in the end, he said, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. And I think that was really what it boiled down to with Job, is he got to a place where that's all that mattered. I don't need an answer. I don't need an explanation, because you're the answer. You're all I need. But you know, when God, it says God blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. And I don't know how you feel about that. but that doesn't bring me a lot of comfort. I'm sure there was a measure of joy and gladness in Job's last days, but that doesn't make up for the lost. And sometimes I think we have to remind ourselves of that. We might look back and say, well, God made up for everything. Well, no, he didn't. God just brought a measure of joy and gladness in Job's last days, but it didn't make up for the other. I mean, would it for you? If you would see your children die one by one, and the memory of them would never leave you, do you think it would make up for the ones that died? I don't think so. And that is the painful reality that I think Job experienced. But he did get to the place where he said, God, I see you. I see you. There's a book that I would like to read to you. A part of a book. It's called The Prisoner in the Third Cell. I wasn't sure if we're going to have time, but I think we will. It's a book that was written by Gene Edwards. It's a fictional story of basically focused on John the Baptist and just a bit of a novel or story, fictional story based on those characters in the Bible. And what it may have been like. Obviously not, it's a made-up story, but there's some deep lessons, I think, that we can learn from it. And it talks a bit about John and his life prior to the coming of Christ in the first part of the book, but then it sort of narrows down to when John was in prison, and it calls John was a prisoner in the third cell, and in this story, there's two other prisoners. And so there's three prisoners in a cell in terrible conditions, maybe for different reasons, but at the end of the day, all three of them are going to die. All three of them are suffering in incredible ways. And all three of them probably were looking for an explanation. They were looking for a reason. And all three of them had the potential to blame something and to be bitter at something. And for all three of them, it was different. So we're going to break in chapter 10, excuse me, with the first prisoner. Herod did it, didn't he? The damnable monster. John, is that you? Do you remember me? I was with you when you were but a child. Oh, I was a man of greatness then. Look at me now. Herod took my home. He took my money without a trial. Without even a hearing. Then he threw me in this hellhole. Now Herod is the one who is rich. Rich on my wealth. And I am but a wretch. I swear a curse upon you, Herod. You monster, wicked man. I served him 20 years faithfully. No man has ever lived who has been so unjustly treated as I. It is unfair what he did, I tell you. Now look at what that heinous man has done. Yorgi has gone and brought a prophet of God to this cursed place. I tell you, every problem, every pain, every sorrow in Judea finds its origin in Herod. There is no justice on this earth, no mercy, no pity. It's all his fault, all of it. John, can you hear me? Mark my word, you will not be here like the rest. You will not rot here like the rest of us. For out there in your desert, you said one thing that is true. There is no end to the wickedness of the human heart, and Herod is the worst of all. I would be a happy, prosperous man today if it were not for that cold-blooded Herod. And the others, those wicked men who conspired against me with him to take everything I had. Panarch, control your tongue, shouted one of the guards. There was a pause. The prisoner in the first cell grew quiet. Unfortunately, though, his shouts had wakened the prisoner in the cell next to him. The thin, bony man moved up to the door of his cell and looked wildly into the eyes of the captain of the guards. John, here? Are you telling me that John is here in this prison? Are you telling me that he has been thrown into this cell 3 of all places? Yes, Sanel. Herod has arrested John and has brought him here. Has God no pity? Has God no feelings? Asked Hanel in a cold, thin voice. Does devotion mean nothing to him? I once trusted in God, just as John does. Are you really here, John? Do you remember me? I lived a devout and holy life before God. You remember, don't you, John? Well, look at what it has brought me. And you see what devotion to God has brought you. Is this to be the end of man? Is this to be the end for man who have loved God and obeyed him? What kind of God is it that would allow such things as we now suffer? God, you have thrown one of your very own servants into a slimy hole, and now thrust one arm through the bars of his cell and clenched his fist and raised his face and spat curses at God. He then ended his ravings with one last pronouncement. Never again will I serve a God who treats men this way. When I needed him, where was he? John, where is your God when you need him the most? Not a single sound rose from the third cell. Whatever John might be thinking, he was keeping his own counsel. Protheus, on the other hand, could not help but wonder. The prisoner in the first cell blames everything on men. The prisoner in the second cell blames everything on God. I wonder whom the prisoner in the third cell will blame. Man, God, or perhaps his cousin. The scene in a village in Galilee called Nain. It is early evening. The streets of the town are packed with people waiting to bring their sick to Jesus. Some of the infirm are blind, some crippled, one is deaf, another frothing at the mouth, is held in restraint by his family. An anxious mother holds her small, fevered baby in her arms. Another mother cradles a crippled child in her lap. All manner of people are there, wrecked by every disease known to man. All have one thing in common. They are seeking Jesus, hoping to receive healing or liberation at his hands. The focal point of this crowd is a house located on one of the smaller streets of the village. In every direction, the streets leading to this house are jammed with people walking through the courtyard, and you will see that it too is filled. There are pathos and anxiety everywhere. Perhaps the thing that makes the waiting ones most anxious is to hear a cry of joy coming from within the house, and then a moment later watch someone depart praising God for healing. At this moment, three roughly dressed, leather-skinned men appear in the courtyard gate. One of the disciples of Jesus recognized these men. He rushes into the house. Just as he is about to tell his master the news of the arrival of these men, a cripple rises on his feet, raises his hands to heaven, and cries out to God in praise for being cured. Lord, the disciples of John are here. Jesus looks up. For one brief moment, there is anxiety in his eyes. Please dismiss the people outside. Bring John's disciples here immediately. With that, the Lord seated himself on the floor and waited passively for the appearance of John's disciples. In a moment, the three men solemnly took their place in front of Jesus. There was a long pause. Then Nadab broke the silence. We have come from John. He is in prison. Herod had him arrested for... Yes, I know, replied the Lord. A few days ago, we were allowed to visit our teacher. He is chained inside a filthy pit. There are rumors that it will not be long before Herod has him killed. There was a pause. Nadab waited to see if Jesus had some response to this word. John sent us to you to ask you a question. It was the only request he made of us. We have traveled far to find you, and yet it is but for the answer to this one question that we come. Again, Nadab paused. Again, no one spoke. Teacher, the question that John would ask of you is this. Nadab paused again, his face flushed. John's question is, are you the Messiah, or should we look for another? A long, stunned silence followed. Pain was felt in the heart of every man in the room. You could read it in the faces of John's three disciples. It was evident upon the faces of the 12, but it was most evident upon the face of the Lord himself. Jesus sighed deeply. For one brief moment, he dropped his head in what seemed to be a gesture of anguish. Looking up again, he addressed the question. Nadab, return to John, tell him for me these things. First, tell John that the blind see, the lame walk, and the deaf hear. Then tell my cousin that the gospel is proclaimed, not only proclaimed, but received with gladness, and that men and women are being set free. The Lord paused, took a deep labored breath, and slowly, purposefully, he continued. Lastly, Nadab, tell John, the Lord's voice choked for a moment. Pain was in his voice. tell my brother John, and blessed is he who is not offended with me. There was another pause. Jesus stood, embraced the three men, and then turned to his disciples. The hour is very late. It is time we departed here. We must go on to the next village. Please dismiss those waiting outside. John's three disciples stood stunned. For a long moment of obvious confusion, they turned and made their departure. The courtyard they crossed was now empty. There were the streets they passed through. Tomorrow will hold for Jesus yet another village. For the disciples of John, tomorrow will hold the enigma of this day. But what will tomorrow hold for those who were sent home that evening? They all departed without being healed. And John, what will be his response to the strange words of his cousin? Three disciples of John squatted down on the slimy floor of the dungeon that had become John's home. Teacher, we have seen your cousin. Did you ask my question? We did. And his answer? Teacher, the answer is very strange. We do not understand it. John sighed. It was as though he knew it wouldn't be. It was as though he knew this would be Nabab's response. His reply? Teacher, he said to tell you that the blind and the dumb and the crippled receive sight and hearing and healing. Then he said to tell you the good news is proclaimed and received with joy. John turned those words over in his mind very slowly. After several minutes, his brow wrinkled. The prisoner leaned forward and asked, "Is that all?" "No, teacher. He said one other thing." And he then dismissed the crowd and bade us farewell. What he said was, "Tell John, and blessed is he who is not offended with me." There was a long silence as three men studied the face of John, hoping to glimpse his reaction to these words. But as always, there was none. Finally, John inquired, "Where was my cousin?" "In a village of Galilee called Nain," responded Nadab. "There were sick people everywhere. Streets, lanes, alleys were all filled with people waiting to be healed. The place was overrun with suffering souls." "Were they being healed?" "Yes, teacher, many were being healed." With these words, John's interest quickened. His frame straightened. "Did you say many?" responded John. "Yes, teacher, many." "Many?" asked John again. The day was puzzled. "Yes, teacher," he answered again. "Many were being healed." "Many," repeated John quietly as to himself. Then he leaned forward again. "Many, Nabab, but not all." For a brief instant, Nadab was at a loss as to what John was saying. Then his own eyes lit up, revealing the shock of what John was observing. "Yes, teacher, you are right. There were many who were being healed, but not all." "Not all." John stared vacantly into space. Had he at last found the answer to the questions which had troubled him so deeply about Jesus? Or had he simply added more questions to his dilemma? We're going to skip a few chapters and chapter 19. And it talks about Jesus. It talks about Jesus in the garden. It talks about Jesus suffering. It talks about the silence of the Father through that suffering. And then in verse 19, a day, and it talks about John eventually being killed in prison. A day like that which awaited John awaits us all. It is unavoidable because every believer imagines his God to be a certain way and is quite sure his Lord will do certain things under certain conditions. But your Lord is never quite what you imagine him to be. You have now come face to face with a God whom you do not fully understand. You have met a God who has not lived up to your expectations. Every believer must come to grips with a God who did not do things quite the way it was expected. You're going to get to know your Lord by faith, or you will not know him at all. Faith in him, trust that is in him, not in his ways. Today you are resentful of those who so callously hurt you. But no, not really. The truth is you are angry with God, because ultimately you are not dealing with men. You are dealing with the sovereign hand of your Lord. Behind all events, behind all things, there is always his sovereign hand. The question is not, why is God doing this? Why is he like this? The question is not, why does he not answer me? The question is not, I need him desperately. Why does he not come rescue me? The question is not, why did God allow this tragedy to happen to me, to my children, or to my wife, or to my husband, or to my family? Nor is it, why does God allow injustice? The question before the house is this. Will you follow a God you do not understand? Will you follow a God who does not live up to your expectations? Your Lord has put something in your life which you cannot bear. The burden is simply too great. He was never supposed to do this. But the question remains, will you continue to follow this God who did not live up to your expectations? And blessed are you if you are not offended with me. Captain, the third cell is empty. It will not be empty long. I have just received word that we are to receive a new prisoner. What has this one done? I do not know. There's always a possibility this one is as innocent as was John. The soldier's response was simple. I hate having such prisoners. We have a prisoner in the first cell who rails against unfairness, against men and against circumstances. We have a prisoner in the second cell who is hostile toward God because of what God has done to him. The new prisoner has arrived, called a voice at the head of the stairs. Take the rope, said Protheus to the guard. Lower the prisoner into the Mare pit. Who is this prisoner? Who is this one who is now to be imprisoned in the third cell? What name will be inscribed beside the cell door? One thing is certain, it is inevitable that this person be sent here. Inevitable, unavoidable, and a sovereign act of God. The prisoner's name? Surely the question is not necessary, dear reader. You are the prisoner in the third cell. And blessed are you if you are not offended with me. Cousin? Yes, John. Jesus? Yes, John, it is I. My Lord and my God, but I had so many questions as I faced death. So did I when I faced death. Just as I did not answer you, neither did my Father answer me. We died in quite similar ways. You died? You died as I did? Yes, John, but I rose from the dead. You rose from the dead, but how? Come, Brother John, take my hand. The moment has come. I will now take you to that place where you know, even as you're known. And he ends with this little encouragement. He says, dear reader, no one can fully understand the pain you feel as you suffer your present situation. Whether it came upon you because of circumstances or by the deeds of men, one thing is certain. Before this present tragedy entered into your life, it first passed through the sovereign hand of God. I'd like to close with something that my sister-in-law, Sarah, posted recently, and I asked her for permission to read that. She says this, if the church could embrace both pain and resurrection power, we'd give people permission to mourn as long as they need to, all the while loving them with a holy gaze toward heaven that would turn their eyes upward also. God is his story, but it's not the end of the story. Pain is not a pathway, but there is a path through pain, a way to walk in it, through it, and finally beyond it. Our souls were meant to settle for something more than devastation. We were born to fly free by the power of the cross of Jesus Christ.